Let's take just a little pause and talk about something that's really exciting. There's a new book coming out in spring 2026 called Applications of Therapeutic Yoga in Integrative Health. It's authored by Amy Wheeler, myself, and Marlisa Sullivan. We've been working really hard on this book for about 18 months, and now it's scheduled for release in spring 2026. This text will bring together philosophical foundations of yoga, emerging research in neuroscience, and evidence-informed methods for applying these teachings in clinical and community settings. The book is designed for healthcare providers, yoga teachers, yoga therapists, educators, and really anyone seeking to clearly understand the why of why yoga works and the how, the mechanism underneath why yoga works. Your purchase of this book will help to advance the field of yoga therapy, and it will support the continued development of resources like this podcast, the Yoga Therapy Hour. And we hope it will serve both you and your clients alike. So please keep an eye out for Applications of Therapeutic Yoga and Integrative Health by Amy Wheeler and Marlisa Sullivan coming out through Routledge Press in 2026. All right, let's get back to the episode. Good morning. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. My name is Amy Wheeler, and I will be your solo host today. I was laying in bed last night thinking about my recording this morning, and I try to do them on Monday morning, right away, first thing, when I'm feeling a little bit fresh for the week and not too worn out. And then if I think about things before I go to bed at night, usually I kind of digest and process them throughout the night. I wake up a few times and have realizations. And then oftentimes if I do some meditation first thing in the morning, it all kind of comes together. Whatever it is that I've been chewing on comes together, and I can have a more cohesive, organized way to express whatever has been inside of me. So that's kind of my process, especially when it comes to creative endeavors like writing or this podcast, I consider a creative endeavor. So the problem that I was chewing on, it's not really a problem, but the thing that I was chewing on last night is, what can I say this morning about the yamas and the niyamas, the ethics of yoga that hasn't been expressed before, that is kind of a new take? Everybody's learned them in the book. They've, gone through them one by one. We all think we know them. And it's really interesting because I woke up this morning and the first thing I saw on LinkedIn was a post from Dr. Ananda Bali Yogi. So I'm going to start with that because I thought that was really serendipitous that we got to see what he was saying about the yamas and niyamas. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. My name is Amy Wheeler and I am your host. Today, we're going to do a solo episode with me, and we're still going deeply into the eight limbs of yoga this year. So let's go ahead and get started. So, for those of you that are listening to this on all the podcast platforms, you're just going to have to listen along. You can kind of see my screen, it's on LinkedIn. The LinkedIn profile is Yogacharya A. B. Bhavanani, Bhavanani. So he wrote something really beautiful. Is ethics the boring part of practice? And he wrote, not for chikitsa, chikitsa meaning yoga therapy. That's what his post is on. The yamas and niyamas serve as a vital yardstick for how we show up for our clients and ourselves. It's time to move beyond clicking accept and start living the code. And he has a full article here on his Medium. It's kind of like a Substack, but it's called Medium. And it's called The Sacred Dharma of Yoga Therapy. And he goes over the codes of conducts, power and responsibility in the yoga therapy relationship, key takeaways such as we have to build trust and it's a sacred space. Therefore, we have to have integrity. We have to guide people. We're not their guru. We're guiding them and we're pointing them back to self and self-empowering the client. And then we ourselves have to have personal integrity. So he goes through all the different yamas: non-harming, truthfulness, non-stealing, making sure that we don't, you know, get greedy. We have to live in moderation. Then he goes through the niyamas: having clarity and purity, contentment, discipline, self-reflection, and be connected to something larger than ourselves. And all of these fall within the context of yoga therapy. But what really got me in this article was the yoga therapist self-care. And there's a really beautiful picture here that shows an unstable yoga therapist. And he's basically saying that the yoga therapist ethical code forces us, not forces, hopefully we want to, have a daily sadhana so that we don't get agitated, we don't misjudge, we don't overreact, we don't burn out, we don't have counter transference, and therefore have these unregulated emotions as a yoga therapist, because then we cannot be that safe container. If our nervous system is very fragile, our window of tolerance as the yoga therapist is very, very small. And we might also get exhausted, which means that our biases are going to grow and our clarity is going to be less. We might get into burnout, leading to complacency. So basically, as part of our ethics as yoga therapists, we have the mandate of a dedicated daily practice. And I think that's different than a lot of healthcare providers, that we require ourselves to show up regulated, grounded, clear, with a long-term practice. So I thought that was very coincidental that I woke up. Sometimes I laugh that whatever's been going on in my mind ends up, you know, coming up on my LinkedIn feed. But I wanted to start there because I think our ethics and our yamas and niyamas as a yoga therapist, I think he's right on track with that. And he said it even better than I could have. So now let's just do a little review of the yamas. And I want to tie this back to something that we talked about at the beginning of season 10 with respect to this idea of ahankara, meaning I need to survive, I own, I possess, I am, all these feelings of not enough, wanting more, struggling, striving, feeling insecure, being competitive, not having that sense of openness and receptivity and oneness, but rather kind of feeling like we are the controller. We have to make it happen. A lot of times they say the ahankara is the doer. Instead of being, we always have to do, do, do. And I think, you know, my experience with myself and my students and our clients is that a lot of the yamas and niyamas are very, very tied to ahankara, that it's very hard to practice your yamas and your niyamas when you're feeling really insecure and in survival mode. And I know a lot of you can relate to that because we as yoga teachers and yoga therapists, a lot of times we're not making a lot of money. Even the top level people, I hear people saying, oh, the people at the top make a lot of money. No, they don't. I know many, many of them, and they end up needing to spend as much money as they're making to keep this wheel going. So I don't see anybody that's making really great living, except maybe for Lululemon or someone selling yoga pants. And the people that are bringing in a large amount of money, they're on a hamster wheel. They're exhausted. They're depleted. They're trying to keep it going for themselves and their faculty and their staff. And they're part of this larger system that requires them to keep pushing. And again, I think this all comes back to ahankara. I must survive. I must provide. I must own and possess and, you know, make sure that I bring in the money. It's been my experience that that is a little bit at odds with yoga, to the point where many of us have had to have other jobs in order to do our yoga. I did that for 25 years I had a day job in order to be able to do my yoga. So just to say, I think a lot of our yamas and our niyamas get broken, not because we're flawed human beings, not because we have bad character, not because we have poor ethics, but because we're frankly in survival mode. And unless we're independently wealthy or somehow maybe have a partner that provides for us or a trust fund or something, win the lottery, most of us, you know, we do have that underpinning that we have to try to make a living doing this. And it's actually quite hard. So first of all, I want to give us all some self-compassion for having that strong ahankara that is trying to survive. Okay, so when we look at ahimsa, to do no harm, to not be violent to each other, but that probably starts from within, to not be violent to ourselves. This yama, the first yama, is the foundation of all the other nine. And so the idea is that if we can release some of the negativity, some of the harmful thoughts and words and actions, and even blame is a big one, this is going to lead to a joyful heart and more peaceful heart and mind. Now, it's really hard because so many people in yoga have such a strong need for social justice. We see people getting harmed. We need to speak out. And we have to do that skillfully. We have to do that skillfully. When am I going to do it? How am I going to do it? Where am I going to do it? Am I the person to speak out about this topic? You know, we have to really examine those things. And we'll get to satya in just a moment. But in terms of ahimsa, the ability to let go of that blame and negativity and lots of harmful thoughts and words, leading to a joyful, peaceful heart. So, I mean, I don't know about you all, but that is really, really hard. That is a full-time practice in and of itself. So let's take this into satya, which is about truth-telling. And our egos would have us be the winner all the time, the right person all the time, the smartest person, the person that everybody loves and needs and wants, the person who's in control, right? When we have all of that going on, and our ego needs to be fed in order to be important, in order to go back to the ahankara, in order to make the money, in order to be at the top of the stack or the pyramid, it becomes harder and harder to see truth for what it is, because now there's this lens of power and control that basically messes up what we're seeing. We may not even know that we're not telling the truth. And I know we've all been there, that there was a point where we did or said something, and then later we got more information and we just buried our head in our hands like, oh, I didn't know that part. But I think that comes with the territory, right? That we only know a small fraction, a small amount of all there is to know. So how could we possibly know? That's why it's probably good to err on the side of being a little more humble, because we don't know what we don't know. Now, again, how do we balance that with speaking out when there's clear evil and wrongdoing? And I really reflect on this a lot. Am I the person to speak out for this issue? Do I know enough? I don't think we all have to speak out for every issue. I think we have to be very skillful and figure out what is ours to speak about. And another thing I've really been thinking about when it comes to satya is, how can I say it in a way that doesn't discourage people from wanting to try, from wanting to work on it, that doesn't divide us? How can we be the carrot instead of the stick? Not to spiritually bypass, but just to bring more people into the conversation and not automatically push them out before the conversation or the work can even get started. So I've been thinking about that a lot and really looking at the people in our community that have the ability to bring us together in conversation instead of starting off with all the really hard, horrible things that just make people feel like giving up before they can even contribute. So again, we have to look at our own ego and figure out how to speak skillfully, how to be inclusive, how to bring people into conversations instead of immediately pushing them out and dividing. And that's ongoing for all of us, and especially when we get quite emotional. And it goes back to the ahankara. When we're feeling insecure, when we're feeling like we don't have enough, the chances of us not following our own desire to be inclusive and to bring people together and to inspire people, it goes down considerably. We've all had experiences with that. So the thing about satya or truth telling is that we are in alignment with a higher will, something bigger than ourselves. You could say supreme contentment or willingness to be a vessel for something larger than yourself and not make it so much about I, me, mine and possessiveness and security and safety and stability, because we all have that. We all need that. But can we also align ourselves with something greater and say, work through me, supreme universe or God or Lord or whatever you want to call it. Can I be a vessel to help move humanity forward and to speak truth with kindness, with generosity, with inclusion? The next yama, asteya, is all about non-stealing. And I think we can all understand how this one, asteya, is very, very connected to ahankara again, that we take someone's ideas and don't give them credit, or we take an entire training manual and put it into AI, and, you know, someone's lifelong work now is in AI GPT chat. You know, there's so many ways we steal from each other. But I think one of the big ones for me is giving our teachers credit, telling people where we learned what we learned, where they could go to learn that. I just noticed that the new president of IAYT, Janet Caldwell, in her first paragraph of accepting being president, she thanked her teachers and listed them. And that's the kind of generosity of spirit and non-stealing. It's the opposite of grasping. It's the opposite of kind of tightening and not wanting anyone to know where you got what you got. It's saying, you know, we're all in this together, and I honor these people, and I'm going to be the teacher of the ones coming after me. And obviously, the chain continues. We're just one little link in the chain. So that idea of asteya, to kind of release the desire to take from others, to make things yours, to possess their words or their ideas. And what they say about asteya is that when you master it, your path unfolds. You are sustained. People come out of the woodwork to help you do what you need to be doing. Why? Because they trust you. They see that you're doing good work. They want to be supportive of that good work. And I've thought about that for years. I remember, you know, back in early 2000s when I was in India studying, and someone had said, oh, that's Deskachar's wife, Menaka. Everything she does, everything she chooses to do just unfolds beautifully for her. And I said, wow, how come? How does someone get like that, that everyone wants to jump in and help? And when you put your mind to something, it just works out. And they said, oh, the yama of asteya, that she has such good relations and such authenticity. And she's practicing her non-harming. She's practicing her speaking her truth with kindness. She doesn't have that feeling of, I have to possess this, I need this, I want this. And therefore, people feel quite comfortable helping her out. And when she says something, it usually happens, and everyone wants to be part of that success. So I thought that was really interesting. I've held on to that for many, many years. I think it's super interesting to look at the places in our lives where things do unfold with ease and we do get that support and nourishment and help, and places where it's just completely blocked and it's not happening for us. So let's move on to Brahmacharya, which many of you know could mean to conserve your sexual energy or right action with your sexuality. But Desikachar always taught it as living in moderation without excess, that we are being an acharya that is in service of Brahma, Brahmacharya. So the idea of releasing obsessive thoughts, words and actions, and excessiveness in what we eat, what we drink, our activities, our cell phone use, our social media activity, even the things we think about, you know, keeping those in moderation, not becoming a workaholic and ignoring our family, and basically knowing that a life of moderation is more likely to keep us regulated. A life of moderation is more likely to keep us regulated, and then we're less likely to steal, to speak untruths, and to be harmful to each other. I have found that to be so true, that when I'm not living a life of moderation and when I'm dysregulated, all the other yamas seem to fall apart. So the thing that tends to happen when we've started to master Brahmacharya is that we have a one-pointed focus. We know who we are, what our gifts are, why we're here, how we can be of service to people. And we stay on that path. It's like a balance beam. You don't run around chasing everything to try to be all things to all people. You know who you are. You've figured out why you're here. And you have that focus as well as strength and vitality to support you in that focus. And that goes back to the eating and the drinking and the sleeping and all those regulatory activities. I went to bed at 8:30 last night because I had a big day today and I want to be regulated and be my best. So that gives me strength and vitality. So yeah, that's a kind of an interesting one, a self-study all by itself. And then let's go to aparigraha, which is non-grasping or non-possessiveness. When we're looking outside of ourselves and grasping for all the external objects to please us, to fulfill our desires, but also to feel safe, it goes back to ahankara. I can't survive. I don't have enough. We're grasping at all the straws that come to us. And I can tell you from practice, a lot of practice, I've gone on 1, 2, 3, and 4 and decade-long detours chasing things that were not meant for me, that I had no business going after, that I didn't have the resources to even complete. I mean, there's one thing to have faith and do good in the world and just say, I'm going to put one foot in front of the other. But there's another thing to be grasping at all the straws and just looking constantly for how can I get what I need. So coming back to Brahmacharya, how can we stay regulated, one-pointed focus, have strength and vitality so that we're not grasping all over the place? And then along with this in aparigraha is releasing our envy. Envy is somebody else has something I want and I don't have it and I feel envious of them. Releasing jealousy. Jealousy is a little different. Jealousy is I have something that I'm afraid is going to be taken away from me, and I feel jealous because so-and-so might take it from me. So envy is that we want something. Jealousy is we have something, but we're afraid it's going to be taken away. And it's very much based in fear that there's not going to be enough, that I'm not going to be okay, I'm not going to survive. And again, this goes right back to ahankara. I hope you're seeing a theme here. That a big part of what we're doing with our yoga ethics is working through those fears of, I'm not enough, it's not going to be okay, and I may not survive. On a very, very deep level, we may not even be conscious of that. So when we have mastered aparigraha, we have a freedom, an internal sovereignty, And we have a lot more discernment about what is for us and what is not for us. I have a friend that she is very discerning. You know, opportunities come her way and she really looks closely at her lifestyle, her energy, her ways that she feels passionate in the world. And she will say no if it doesn't all line up. The finances, I mean, she's looking at it from all angles. And if it doesn't line up, she's not going to do it. Even though she is not a wealthy person and she lives paycheck to paycheck, right? You can see how difficult that is to be that discerning and wait for the right thing at the right time. Now, sometimes we do have to get the day job. Sometimes we have to do things that we didn't plan on, didn't want to, that are a little bit hard, but we're doing that in the spirit of discernment. Like, I have to do this to get through until I can find the place for myself. We don't get off track and, you know, run for 10 years in a loop that we probably had no business being in. So all of that, those are the five yamas. I'm going to save the five niyamas for next month because that's our topic for next month. I'm going to do the same type of thing in an episode next month for the niyamas. But I just want to review that as we follow our yamas, we are left with a peaceful heart and a joyful heart. We learn to align ourselves with the higher good, and we have a lot of happiness and satisfaction as a result of that. We find nourishment and support on the things we choose to do in life, the path that we're on. We have a one-pointed focus with strength and vitality, and we have a lot more discernment and freedom. Now, I want to give credit to my friends who helped me with this beautiful chart, the Yoga Sangha in New Orleans. Some of my friends named Libby and Becky and their colleagues and students gave me this chart many, many years ago, and I use it a lot. It's actually a really beautiful chart. So thank you to all of our friends in Mandeville, right outside New Orleans. We're really grateful that you are sharing these teachings with us from the tradition of T. Krishnamacharya. So now we have covered the philosophical teachings of yoga. And some of you may have noticed by now that I have found my path and I'm very discerning about what I want to talk to you all about because I can't tell you everything. I don't know a whole lot of things, but this intersection of yoga philosophy and neuroscience is just so wonderful. I love it. It's all I want to do all day long. I have to practice my brahmacharya and my moderation because I can get pretty carried away. So when we go to the yoga philosophy and the idea of ahankara and will I have enough and is it going to be okay and will I make it through? Can I pay my bills? What we're really talking about is how do we cultivate a felt sense of safety and stability and where we can have a flexible nervous system that moves in and out, that's not stuck in fight or flight or freeze. Some of you know that, you know, this is outlined in great detail by polyvagal theory and Stephen Porges. So when we're in this state of a felt sense of safety, our heart rate is more regulated and flexible. It can kind of go up and down as needed with different activities throughout the day. Our breath is more easeful and again, adaptable. It can breathe a little faster when we need more oxygen or be a little slower with our breath when we're in a more mindful, still state. Also, when we're in this felt sense of safety, our social engagement systems are in line. We're much more connected to one another. And we can really see each other's faces and eyes and get those signals of safety from one another, which is going to make us more likely to co-regulate. And when there's ambiguity, meaning we're really not sure that person's intentions or what they just said, we attribute that that is a positive thing. We give unconditional positive regard rather than assuming the worst and feeling that it's threatening. And, you know, we go through the world all day long with these ambiguous signals from other people, and we have a choice on how to interpret them. So these are the types of things that when we're in that strong ahankara, that mode where we're not feeling safe, we're not feeling provided for, all of this shifts. The heart rate becomes high and inflexible. The breath becomes shallow and doesn't adapt to the situation that we're in. Our social engagement systems go offline. Our inner dialogue often becomes pretty negative and assumes the worst and feels threatened. So you can see the yoga philosophy and ahankara is directly related to this felt sense of safety that we're trying to cultivate in yoga. I think it's just so ironic to think about how many yoga teachers came to yoga because they finally found safety within themselves, within their bodies, within their relationships. And it was such an amazing discovery, only to come and be in it as a worker, someone who's trying to teach that, and then get back into that fight, flight, and freeze because needs are not always provided for. Just, you know, interesting ironies to reflect on. And that's why I always say, hey, let's not quit our day job if we don't have to. You know, there are times we can. I'm in a situation right now where my day job is yoga therapy, but this is the first time in my entire life, and I'm 55 years old with a PhD, and I've never had this before where my day job is the love of my life, yoga. You know, it's always been kind of separate. So that's just how it is with our field at this moment. All right, let's talk a little more neuroscience, that your brain is a prediction machine. It's called predictive processing. And your brain is constantly asking, based on what's happened in the past, all that stuff, what's likely to happen next? So if someone has repeated experiences of resolution and coming together after a fight or a difficulty, if they know how to repair a relationship, they've done that a lot in the past, they're more likely to be able to assume that's going to happen for future difficulties. If people have had support from others in the past, their predictive machine, aka brain, will assume that they're going to get support from others in the future. If someone's had the internal resources or even external resources and capacity to cope with challenges, their brain will predict that that will happen in the future. I'll have the inner and external resources to cope. So the brain begins to generate predictions like, I think this will work out. We'll find a way through. It's going to be okay. I'm safe. You can see how helpful that would be. And this is why the family that we were born into, the socioeconomic status that we were born into, the safety emotionally of the people that surrounded us in the past, probably as a child, it really kind of sets your brain up for that predictive processing. So what happens if you were born into a family that wasn't mentally, emotionally, and spiritually sound, that had addiction, that had lack of trust, that didn't nourish and care and support, that maybe didn't have the finances to give you what you needed? Well, your predictive processing is going to be more in line with the ahankara. Something might go wrong. I always need a backup. What's the worst case scenario? I think I'll prepare for that. I laugh because there was once a book in a store that said, the guide for the worst case scenario, and I bought it. And now I look back, I'm like, oh my gosh, my poor little ahankara. She was really not having what she needed. So I guess I'm living proof that you can start to restructure that. It's taken many, many decades of work, but you can start to find your way through something you might call trust, the neuroscience of trust. And it's not naive. It's literally patterned learning over time, telling yourself things could go well, things could go better than I expected. I am open to my little brain shutting down and something out there doing something wonderful. I am open to receiving. I am open to support. I don't want to steal. I do want to live in moderation. I want to be regulated. I am regulated. Like all the things we just talked about with the yamas are part of this new patterned learning over time where your brain becomes a predictive processor for goodness and success and stability. And this isn't spiritual bypassing. It is, I might call it brainwashing, but it's super hard work. I think spiritual bypassing is bypassing all of the work and being like, oh, everything's fine. No, this reprogramming the way you think, feel, behave, speak, and interact to move away from the ahankara and towards feeling that you can trust yourself, the universe, and the people around you, that's not a spiritual bypass. That's actually really hard work. All right, let's talk a little more neuroscience, the role of the prefrontal cortex. So when we are regulated, our prefrontal cortex is online. It's able to analyze, make decisions, have discernment. It's kind of in charge. And that's what, you know, differentiates us from animals is we have a much bigger prefrontal cortex, whereas they're working more with the midbrain and the hindbrain. So as humans, we have this beautiful gift of the thinking brain, for better or for worse, and we can start to figure out when is my emotional brain taking over, my amygdala? When is my hindbrain taking over, my survival brain, which, by the way, we need both of those. They're both really great things, but are we living our life from the amygdala, from the fear? Are we living our life from the hindbrain that is just wanting to survive and create homeostasis? So we can learn to see ourselves going to those places where we're getting a little bit about excessive and in responses from the amygdala, from the hindbrain. And instead, we can step back and say, whew, this is difficult and it's not permanent. I can do this. Or I have handled really hard things before and I feel certain that I can again. Or one of my favorites, there's so many options that I can't yet see. There's so many things unfolding with goodness to help me and support me that I don't yet see. And so with this kind of work, instead of the brain narrowing down to worst case scenario and worry and control, it kind of opens things up. Some people might even call it prayer, using your prefrontal cortex in a way to say, I'm open to being helped and supported. A lot of the work that I did around this came from daily meditation practices and chanting around the goddess Lakshmi, who, you know, obviously has a lot to do with what we're talking about today. So in case you were wondering, that's how I worked through a lot of this. So let's just talk a little bit longer about the amygdala and that it's wanting to protect us, just like the ahankara is wanting to protect us. It's not a bad thing. It's just that sometimes it gets overreactive, and that's when we get kind of unregulated. So we start to interpret neutral situations as threatening, and we imagine these worst-case scenarios, and our whole system organizes around survival instead of what's possible. And in this state, our body's, it's asking, will this work out for me? And the answer that when we're in that fear response is no, it will not work out for you. And so we're trying to move away from that and move into better case scenarios, openness, receptivity, knowing that there's many possibilities in the universe that you have never thought of and that there may be something better than you could ever imagine. That's what Lakshmi is all about. When you look at Lakshmi sitting there, she's on a lotus flower, which the lotus flower is taking the mud and the muck and turning it into this beautiful, nourishing flower that she's sitting on. And her hands are open. She has receptivity. She's not closed down. She's not thinking worst case scenario. She's saying, universe, I am open. So those are just a few ways that we can see the neuroscience of trust of openness, of receptivity. And in that, we're actually helping shrink the actions of the ahankara. Our yamas and our niyamas are more likely to blossom. So that's really what I wanted to tell you today. It's kind of a unique and interesting take on the yamas and tying it to the amygdala and the neuroscience of trust. But I think it's something that so many of us as yoga teachers and yoga therapists have gone through throughout our whole career and maybe even now. And it's something to reflect on. I know I've been reflecting on it for almost 30 years. Oh my gosh, it's a lot. So if we don't have it all figured out, or maybe it is very triggering to even hear me saying the things I'm saying today, I think that's an okay thing to have happen too, to feel triggered and to feel defensive and aversion and wanting to push this conversation away. I can just say maybe journal, find a friend and talk about it, find a mentor and work through it and see what's on the other side or see what's inside of that. So thank you for being with us today. It's been a wonderful morning and I'm going to go have breakfast. I am in receptivity mode. My husband has made me breakfast and it's waiting up there. And then I'm going to have a great day at work because I am feeling regulated, happy, dharmic, and ready to go live my life purpose today. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll talk soon. Thank you for being a listener of the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. We have done over 200 episodes, and we have had over 200,000 downloads. And we hope that in some small way, we have supported you mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. If you'd like to support the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast in 2026, there's several meaningful ways you can do so. First, you can become a member of our Patreon community and donate as little as $5 a month to keep the podcast going. Your contribution helps us to sustain the depth and quality of conversations on the podcast. A second option is that you become an Optimal State mobile app member for both Android and iPhone. Again, this is about $5 a month, and we're going to start providing a lot of amazing content on our mobile app in 2026. We'll definitely want you to be part of that community. We also have a book coming out called Applications of Therapeutic Yoga in Integrative Health. This book will be published by Routledge Publisher in spring 2026. It's written by Amy Wheeler and Marlisa Sullivan. We hope you'll consider purchasing this book when it comes out in the spring of 2026. Again, the name is Applications of Therapeutic Yoga in Integrative Health by Wheeler and Sullivan. For those of you who are seeking advanced training in therapeutic yoga or in yoga therapy, please consider checking out the programs at Notre Dame of Maryland School of Integrative Health. We have a MS in yoga therapy, and we also have a post-master's degree therapeutic yoga for licensed healthcare providers that's starting in the fall of 2026. In addition, we have a comprehensive Ayurveda certificate program also geared towards licensed healthcare providers. Each one of these programs is a pathway designed to support healthcare professionals and yoga teachers and yoga therapists who are ready to integrate these teachings into clinical, education, and community settings. All right, thanks for listening and thanks for supporting the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow, in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever. So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.